Internet Talk Radio, Flame of the Internet.
Geek of the Week, and we're talking to Bob Braden, who's at the Information Sciences Institute at the University of Southern California. Bob, welcome to Geek of the Week.
Thank you.
You're the director of DARTnet, which is ARPA's experimental network out there. Could you maybe tell us what DARTnet is and what is it? I mean, how does that relate to the rest of the Internet?
Okay, well, director is maybe a little strong.
Coordinator.
A coordinator is more accurate. I sort of fell into that because the DARTnet work came out of discussions in the end-to-end research group of the IRTF that I chair, have chaired for since the start.
That's the Internet Research Task Force.
It's Internet Research Task Force, right. And it was a hotbed of Internet-related research people, and these people generally originally had the ARPANET to play with, and then they had the Internet to play with, but the Internet became too successful to be a research vehicle anymore, and people don't like us to break it. So ARPA agreed to create a network which we could break, and that's DARTnet. It's a cross-country T1 network, a very simple backbone spine that connects some 10 research sites. We use SunSpark stations as packet switches. A very important part of it is that the packet switches are programmable. And so to do an experiment on DARTnet, you typically boot your own version of the operating system with its own network code and take over the whole system and the whole network and do experiments.
And what kind of experiments are done on there?
Well, mostly experiments where you need to break the network. The center of interest has been in experiments concerning the dynamics of networks, issues of congestion, of multiplexing, of queuing, of scheduling. Now, of resource reservation, particularly, there have been some experiments, but not a lot in routing because it doesn't have a very interesting topology, and so it isn't terribly useful for routing. And in fact, the kinds of things you want to do in routing, besides simple demonstrations that it works, involve scaling issues, and for that you really need simulations because you can't afford to put it together. 100,000 node network for scaling experiments. But you can do a lot of really useful scientific work on packet scheduling kinds of issues. If you get a bunch of packets in different traffic classes, which ones get forwarded? And generally that's been the area.
So that's the area of resource reservation, or is this really, are we reserving bandwidth here, or are there other techniques that are being looked at?
Well, there are experiments with fair queuing, which is not reservation, but has to do with the dynamics of traffic and congestion. And more recently, we've been doing explicitly resource reservation experiments. Our goal is to develop a technology which can be used in the entire Internet to allow us to do voice and video acceptably with reasonable quality across the entire Internet.
There's a conventional wisdom that says the Internet has worked and it's fine for non-real-time services, mail and FTP,
yeah.
And one can even consider Telnet to be somewhat non-real-time. But when it comes to voice and video, that won't work and we're going to have to move back to a connection-oriented system. Do you think the Internet is going to have to make that about-face, or we're going to have to kind of get rid of packet switching and move back to a connection-oriented network?
Well, I don't think anyone believes that anymore. there has been, well, you need to distinguish the discipline you use for forwarding packets. Who goes in the what queue and when you fill and when you empty the queues, from the question of the setup protocol, the way you actually make the reservations. The first issue, the scheduling of packet forwarding, really isn't connectionless. Can be done in a connectionless way. We can do this with IP packets or IPNG packets or CLNP packets. It doesn't make any difference. But you need state in the switches, which reflect the classes or the sessions for which you're going to reserve bandwidth. And there have been two general approaches suggested for setting up that state. One is a connection-oriented approach, represented by SD2, and now we're currently developing a connectionless approach called RSVP, and that's the work being done in .NET now. Over the years, we've tend to come to believe very strongly in connectionless approaches as providing more robust service and service which allows plug and play, which allows people to connect stuff together, built by a variety of different vendors with only a modest amount of careful engineering, and have it work correctly.
Well, how does RSVP work? What are some of the techniques you're looking at to do this connectionless resource reservation?
Well, basically, you send packets along the path of your data to set up the reservation, and that creates state in the routers along the path, and that state times out. There's no hard mechanism to remove that state. It simply times out, and you refresh it. You periodically resend the same data before it times out. And if for example, a route changes, then the refresh packets follow the new path and set up the state on the new path. And the state on the old path, which is now not in use, times out. So it's all done on a sort of soft state basis.
And do these packets guarantee that you'll have a certain amount of bandwidth? Is it a best effort guarantee, if one can use that oxymoron?
That's an issue of the scheduling algorithm you use, the model for traffic control. And that's independent of the way you do the actual setup. The setup protocol carries along what we call flow spec, which defines the quality of service you want. And you may, of course, get back an error message saying, I'm sorry, I can't provide that service. But it's still very much, pretty much an area of research, what the qualities of service need to be. There is a model which is very popular, which is developed by Dave Clark at MIT and Lisha Zhang and Scott Schenker at Xerox PARC. We call the CSZ model, which is the one we're pursuing, but there are other proposals.
If we're looking at classes of service and reserving resources, or certainly at least saying we'd like some resources, the Internet currently is based on flat fees. Users don't pay, or users pay a certain amount per month. Does that mean if we have different classes of service, every single user is going to say we want the best possible service, of course? And how do we handle that with the current charging model? Is there a dichotomy there?
Well, that's a very important issue. The researchers in this area believe quite clearly that resource reservation can only work if there is some feedback to the user. Now, that doesn't have to mean charging, but there has to be some felt cost to the user if he asks for better quality service. because otherwise, you say, the system will just break down. Everyone will ask the best quality of service, and then nobody will get anything. So that some sort of a usage-based resource feedback is essential. And, well, we say that, and so far we haven't done anything about it.
What kind of feedback might that be? Obviously, taking your money is a good way of doing feedback. Are there other ways of doing that? Does the screen get muddier if you want better service?
Well, of course, it's probably true that the Internet is going to move towards a real dollar basis for most people. So at some level, there's going to be money exchanged. When I go to work and I pick up the phone and make a phone call, I'm not aware directly of the cost of that call. Now, I may get a monthly summary from my company saying that my department spent so much or even my telephone spent so much. If I start making a lot of long-distance calls after hours to Japan if the phone bill begins to mount up in some particular area, some administrator may ask, well, what's going on? The company may decide to buy a different local phone system, a different PBX, which is able to optimize the traffic in some way, like it tries different services and gets the cheapest service, is able to compute which carrier to use at what time of day. I think that the network charges will probably be analogous to this, that companies will get bulk charges, which they may or may not reflect down to the individual user, but there will be someone in charge who is looking at the charges, at the costs, and optimizing them and deciding that, well, gee, maybe we ought to buy this better FTP program, which will save us 20% on our average costs. Or maybe we can't afford quite the same quality of service as a whole. So there will be some indirect administrative feedback. I think most people won't see it directly.
Controlling costs in a network or assigning costs, we're implying accounting in some respect. How are we going to account for the use of resources in the Internet? Is this going to be something that every single router will maintain a log of every packet? Is it going to be simply at the endpoints where we keep a log of FTP sessions? Or is it someplace in between or someplace different?
That's a controversial issue. And we haven't really thought enough about it or done enough experiments. So I don't really know the answer, except that we believe in general what it costs in some sense and by some metric, whether it's real money or some usage measure, what it costs has to reflect what you do, what you ask for. If you ask for a better quality of service, it has to cost in some sense more.
And any ideas on how we might do accounting? Because right now the Internet is based on a This is probably unfair, but a no security, no accounting, open mm-hmm. model. How might we begin doing accounting? Do you have any at least ideas, if not answers?
It's I think a reasonable model might be that this sort of usage feedback is only necessary for people who ask for better than minimum service. So if you only ask for the vanilla best effort service, you may not bother. But if you ask the reserve bandwidth for a video signal, that's a significant resource, and it needs to be accounted to you in some way. As I say, the fact that you have to ask for reservations, whether you do it in a connectionless or connection-oriented way, in either case, you have to explicitly set up a reservation, and that act presumably triggers some sort of accounting. Now, whether you actually count packets or whether you only whether the cost is based upon usage or upon reservation is one of the basic questions, and there are arguments both ways. In other words, if you reserve 64 kilobits over a certain path, and you have the right to use 64 kilobits, do you get charged on that basis regardless of whether you use it, or do you only get charged on the packets you use?
You're looking at a variety of research issues on how the network will function. We're currently going through a process of engineering the next generation of an Internet protocol.
Yes.
And that's based on a crisis in the address space and in the routing tables. There is some disagreement as to whether we should just solve that address problem or whether we should, at the same time, while we're going through that transition, try to tackle some of these more long-term issues. How do you see that coming out?
Well, I think that the address space problem, which is absolutely real, is getting a lot of attention because people understand it. The network operators understand it very, very painfully, and they see death coming, and or at least a limitation of their growth, and that's for them that's a very serious issue. But I think that people are not paying enough attention to the explosion of VAT, the use of video and audio, and the fact that all our workstations now are beginning to come with audio and video built in. And soon that'll be absolutely standard. And that's a tremendous traffic generator. And this stuff is nice. People use it. We use it because we're developing this technology in .NET. A number of us on .NET have an open channel for audio at all times when .NET's not being broken by somebody. And we just use it. And we use video quite a lot, and it's very helpful.
So by an open channel, it's as if you're in a room with all these other people.
Essentially, except we keep our mics muted most of the time. If I want to talk to Steve Kasner on the other side of my building or Steve Deering in Palo Alto, I can't just say Steve. I have to say, Steve Deering, are you there? And when we chat, and that's very, very handy.
And that's going to be all over the world. That same type of
I believe so. And travel is just horrendous. We can't do all the. There are too many meetings and too much travel. And the only thing which is standing in the way at this point is the quality is rather poor because we don't have bandwidth reservation. And as soon as we begin to have bandwidth reservation, the other thing is that people are more and more beginning to use this on their LANs. It's going to become more and more popular on LANs. And then they're going to say, well, why can't we use it across the wide Internet? So I think that very shortly there's going to be great pressure on the vendors and on the operators to provide resource reservation service Internet-wide.
Well, how are we going to do that? Do we know how to do that?
Well, that's the research which I've been talking about on .NET. And our intent is to provide a set of algorithms and prototype routines and protocols, which then can be introduced into the IETF process. And I believe that my current reading is that it would be a very good idea to get that in sync with the IPNG work.
There's a sense of urgency about IP Next Generation, about getting it out there and avoiding the address crisis. Will the resource reservation work be ready in time, or would that slow down the process of deciding on the next IP? Can we afford to wait for resource reservation?
Well, that's would you like to peer into my crystal ball? As noted at last night's IP Decide BOF, there's a great deal of uncertainty about how soon we have to we have to get IPNG developed. It looks like CIDR is going to save us for a while, but we don't know how long a while is. I guess it seems clear we need to move ahead with all deliberate speed on IPNG. And I think we have a chance. I think we have a chance to get the resource reservation stuff far enough along in time that it can be factored into the decision and development of IPNG. Our goal has been to begin to introduce the resource reservation ideas and work into IETF. Well, actually, at one point, our goal was to do it this fall. We're not going to make that, but by early next year,
mm-hmm.
early calendar 94. And I think we ought to synchronize the two efforts.
How long do we have before the addressing and routing table explosion problem kill us? How bad is the crisis? I know you don't have an answer, but do you have a range? Are we going to run out of addresses in 50 years? Are we going to run out next month?
Well, I think the numbers which have been mentioned recently range from, two to five, 6 years. And
that's if we deploy CIDR and if it works.
Yeah, assuming CIDR, yeah. Oh, CIDR will work, but how effective it will be, we don't know yet.
You're executive director of the Internet Architecture Board, and in fact, you're a longtime member of the IAB.
Charter member, actually.
Charter member. That's
since
about as long as you can get.
Since 1981, when it started.
How does a group like the IAB monitor the tremendous output coming out of the IETF? How do you judge and review security and routing and resource discovery and X500 at the same time?
It was only in the old world order that we did all that, and the answer would have to be fairly poorly. But in the new world order, we play a much more of a management kind of a role. We are tasked to worry about to do some long-range planning, to try to step back and think about the architecture and about the general principles of what's going on. And we also are tasked to serve as a court of appeals, basically, to the IESG that has the primary responsibility on standards.
Do you see that function being
so we watch and listen a lot?
You watch and listen, and if necessary, you step in when the IESG can't make a decision or was challenged on.
Well, that's the principle. I mean, in fact, that hasn't yet happened, so we don't know how well that's going to work. But that selection process, I think, is really important, and it's really important to the community that work.
The internet has always been a real dynamic laboratory, a place where new things happen and we're not afraid to try to move forward. And now it's becoming a global production service, very, very operational. We're seeing telephone companies offering IP service. Is that going to change the Internet? Is it going to be a different place?
Well, that's an imponderable. When there are such big bucks involved, it's hard to see how we can be allowed to continue to play the way we have.
Is the playing good? Is this
Well, I mean, we've been tremendously successful. We've built a great thing, without wearing suits and ties. But there are an awful lot of suits and ties in the world, and when there are such big bucks involved and big political, when the Vice President of the United States starts talking about it, and when you find jokes in New Yorker, which talk about the internet with no further explanation, you know you're in trouble.
This is the dog joke that you're
referring
to.
Yes, a dog joke, right.
There was a cartoon in the New Yorker in which one dog's sitting on a chair and looking at a terminal, and there's another dog on the floor, and the dog on the chair says, on the internet, nobody knows you're a dog.
Right. But what was remarkable about that was it appeared in the New Yorker, and it just used the term internet without a comment, without explanation. And, well, I read a lot of articles about the internet today in New York Times. It's part of the discourse. It's becoming part of the discourse of the nation.
You started working on the internet when? Were you part of the original ARPANET team?
Yes. I actually started networking back in 1970 when the ARPANET started. I was at UCLA and in charge of systems programming for the what was a supercomputer in those days, an IBM 360-91. And ARPA wanted to have a supercomputer on the ARPANET as a resource, because ARPANET was supposed to be about resource sharing, remote access to computing resources, which were then very expensive, relatively. And so they came to the computing center at UCLA and asked us if we would make our IBM system a host on the ARPANET. So I was in charge of that and got interested in the problem of protocols and got interested in the worked on FTP protocol and was responsible for implementing the whole suite. I didn't do the work at that point. I was a manager, but I went to working group meetings and got to know John Postel and Steve Crocker and the very creative group of people who started all that. So I have some number of RFCs, written back in the hundreds and 200s in the early 70s. And we were something like the 5th or, I don't know, 10th host on the ARPANET. In about 1973, I guess, we got fully operational. Well, those were very exciting days, interesting days.
Did you have any idea that the internet would grow like it did?
Well, this was the ARPANET, and the ARPANET grew in sort of predictable ways. But then in 1974, the internet idea was developed at ARPA by Bob Kahn and Vint Cerf, wrote the classical paper on internet protocols. 1974, and then 1975 they started the Internet Research Program, and about 1977, I guess I got an ARPA contract to change our host software at UCLA to support TCP/IP, and so I wrote the TCP/IP code for the IBM system, and this time I did cut the code, so I became part of the Internet Research Program at that point. I was actually in the TCP end. When Vint went to ARPA, he separated the IP and the TCP groups to work separately, and I was in the TCP group.
This is Internet Talk Radio, Flame of the Internet. You've been listening to Geek of the Week. You may copy this program to any medium and change the encoding, but may not alter the data or sell the contents. To purchase an audio cassette of this program, send mail to radio@ora.com. Support for Geek of the Week comes from Sun Microsystems. Sun, the network is the computer. Support for Geek of the Week also comes from O'Reilly & Associates, publishers of The Global Network Navigator, your online hypertext magazine. For more information, send mail to info@gnn.com. Network connectivity for the Internet Multicasting Service is provided by MFS DataNet and by UUNet Technologies. Executive producer for Geek of the Week is Martin Lucas. Production manager is James Rowland. Rick Dunbar and Curtis Generous are the sysadmins. This is Carl Malamud for the Internet Multicasting Service, Town Crier, to the Global Village.